Sunday reading day, and that means we're going to be reading from The Spirits of Christmas, The Dark Side of the Holidays. Be back in a minute. Grab your popcorn and snacks. Find a comfy spot, take a seat or lie down, and let me transport you to a place of fantasy, ghost stories, ancient legends, odd creatures, alien encounters, and other magical topics. You may even decide to join the conversation. From faraway lands to your own backyard, with a small dash of pixie dust, turn out the lights and open your minds. The journey is about to begin. Hey, whoa, I missed it over here. Sorry about that. I was looking at TikTok. Hey, everybody. Welcome. Happy Sunday. Happy Super Bowl Sunday. I understand everybody's getting ready to go buy the big food. In fact, that's why I decided to go an hour early so I can take off to the store and get myself some little snacks for the Super Bowl. My name is Charlotte. I'm going to be your host for the next hour. I'm also the owner of the California Haunts Paranormal Investigation Team based out of Sacramento, California. We're 45 strong up and down the state. Which means if you have a paranormal need, we could help you out, but it might take us a while to get to you. California is a huge state. But we also have people in Nevada, Washington, Hawaii, and Old Point South. All right. Well, I kind of laugh at that. I'm sorry. It's one of those inside jokes. Welcome, TikTok. We are broadcasting live today on TikTok. TikTok, Facebook, YouTube, and Rumble. For the first time, we're broadcasting on Rumble. This is what we call our Sunday reading day, where I read from a paranormal thing book. We might be finishing the book today. Hopefully we are. We've been reading from this. It's been a holiday story book, not so much Christmas-oriented, but things that happen during the holiday season. You know, good things, bad things, fun things, you know, whatever things, but they're spooky stories. Some are true, some aren't, and I'm just looking to see who's on there. I can't acknowledge you. Thank you. Thank you for the likes. I would like as many likes as possible for this TikTok, please, if you could. I'm not going to be able to acknowledge you guys over on TikTok because I can't see the screen over there, okay? So I can't do any acknowledging. Hopefully I have a moderator in there somewhere. But if not, just be on your best behavior, okay? We're just going to have some fun. We're going to read for the next hour. If we finish the book early, I do have another book set up on my other tablet, so there'll be like a 2-3 minute delay while it powers up, okay? But, double tap that, everybody. Like, see how many likes we can get today with this, okay? And if you do gift it, which would be nice of you, just know that I can't respond to it because I can't see it, okay? Because I'm way over here. Because if you know anybody that sees my regular shows, I am wearing glasses, reading glasses during my show, okay? So, I'm going to start reading here, and the book is The Spirits of Christmas, The Darkness of the Holidays by Sylvia Schultz. Sylvia is a good friend of the California Haunts, and every year we get to read from her book, and her book every year gets better and better because the more I read it, the more things I see that I missed the first couple rounds through. Okay? So, like I said, I'll be reading for an hour, and again, if we finish early, then I'll start the other book. Okay, I've got another great book with some stories you might recognize and some stories you might not recognize. All right, so here we go. Let's just get to it. And you guys can see my shirt tonight, the Haunted Mansion shirt. See it? You can see my shirt today. So I hope everybody's having a good Sunday. I hope everybody has good munchies. So here we go. Here we go, you guys. The Battle of Edgehall. The English Civil War was a vicious contest between the Roundheads, led by Oliver Cromwell, and the Royalists who backed King Charles I. The first and bloodiest battle of the war was fought on a field called Edgehill on October 23, 1642. The battlefield of Edgehill was just 7 miles outside the English town of Banbury. It was here that two armies, each 20,000 strong, fought bitterly for hours, leaving 4,000 soldiers dead on the field. Neither side actually won the battle, although both sides claimed victory. The result of the battle was simply that the Roundheads were not able to stop the Royalists on their march towards London. The battle was over, but 4,000 dead men still wanted to have their say. 2 months after the event, on Saturday morning, Christmas Eve, 1642, the armies met again to continue the battle. But these were not the soldiers of Charles I and Cromwell. These were phantom armies, drums beating, muskets firing, horses neighing, and cannons roaring. All in the skies over the battlefield. Several shepherds and other country folk were the first witnesses to this ghostly reenactment. They stood rooted to the spot in terror for 3 hours, while the phantom battle raged above them. When the armies vanished, the witnesses raced to the nearby town of Kyneton to find William Wood, the magistrate, and a minister, Samuel Marshall, just to be on the safe side. Wood and Marshall listened to the incredible story, but they wanted to see this phenomenon for themselves. That night, the night of Christmas, the two men went to the Edge Hill battlefield, accompanied by the original witnesses, plus most of the townspeople. Half an hour after they got there, the spectral battle started up, just as fiercely as the night before. The witnesses, all terrified at what was going on, scattered and rushed home and locked their doors behind them. The rest of the week was quiet, and the townspeople dared to think that the haunting was over. But the next Saturday night, the phantom armies fought for 4 hours. Sunday night brought them on again. The minister, Mr. Marshall, had to move out of town. The continuous battles were simply too much for him. Others left too, but Wood, the magistrate, and most of the other townspeople stayed. Sure enough, the next weekend, there was another double feature. News of the repeating apparition reached the ears of King Charles I. He was immediately curious. After all, it was his army that was tearing it up in the skies over Edge Hill. He sent 6 trusted men to Kyneton, to investigate the phenomenon. The men listened to Wood and others tell of amazing sights they've seen. And that Saturday and Sunday nights, they saw the vicious battle for themselves. Staring up at the sky, the men even recognized personal friends of theirs who had fallen during the actual battle in October. The 6 investigators returned to the king and testified under oath as to what they had seen. Within days of their report, the king ordered a pamphlet written up, containing all the eyewitness testimony of the recurring battle of Edge Hill. The phantom armies that fought so bitterly for so many nights gradually disappeared, but reports still came of noises, of battle, of the pounding hooves of hard galloping horses, of phantom riders heard thundering across the deserted battlefield, of cannons still discharging their deadly loads. For centuries after the battle, long after Cromwell's victory, long after Charles I lost his head, the ghosts of Edge Hill still could not find rest. Cool story. Cool story. 50 Berkeley Square. Some houses just seem to exude an air of evil. They don't have to be crumbling stone castles with ghosts from centuries past. Some, like Borley Rectory in England, seem to be repositories of creeping horror, with poltergeist activity off the charts for no known reason. Some, like the Lutz home in Amityville, were the scene of some ghastly crime in years past, the stain which still clings to the walls and permeates the air. And some houses are just plain creepy for no reason. A shut-in died in a house decades ago, or a mass murderer was rumored to bury the bodies of his victims in the cellar floor. For whatever reason, real or imagined people talk about certain houses in hushed tones, and kids cross the street to avoid walking past them on their way to school. 50 Berkeley Square is such a house. Built in the late 18th century, the home was in a fashionable district of London, but there was always something unfashionably off about the house. Prime Minister George Canning, who lived in the house until his death in 1827, complained of hearing strange noises in the house. The hauntings really began, as far as anyone can tell, in the 1830s. Apparently, a maid went mad with fright when something suddenly appeared in her bedroom. One account, published in a magazine of the day, said that she was found standing in the middle of her room, rigid as a corpse, with hideously glaring eyes, unable to speak. She was taken to St. George's Hospital, an insane asylum, where she died the very next day. After this disturbing incident, the family who lived in the house refused to go into the maid's room. They said that when they touched the walls, they were found saturated with electric horror. The house became plagued with poltergeist phenomena, all the standard issue creepiness of a haunted house, rattling chains, rapping noises, eerie blue lights that drifted from room to room, and unearthly screams. Lord Littleton heard of the maid's haunted room and showed up at the house asking to spend the night there. He armed himself with 2 blunderbusses loaded with buckshot and silver coins, easier to come by than silver bullets. Littleton came down the next morning, his cocky attitude shaken right out of him. He claimed that something horrible had come into the room and launched itself at him. He was able to fire one of his guns at it, and it disappeared. Littleton couldn't describe what it was that he'd seen in that room. Another visitor, Sir Robert Warboys, was deeply skeptical of the whole idea of a haunting. He demanded to be allowed to spend the night in the haunted room. He, too, was armed with a pistol, and he took a bell with him just in case he needed to summon help quickly. Sometime after midnight, the family was jolted awake by the violent ringing of the bell. They raced up to the maid's room, listening all the while for the shot of a pistol. It never came. They burst into the room and found Sir Robert sprawled half on the bed. The pistol lay on the floor and fired. Sir Robert was unalived, and he had not died peacefully. His wide-open eyes stared unseeingly at some unspoken horror, and his lips were drawn back over his teeth in a feral grin of fear. Sir Robert Warboys read the coroner's report, had been frightened to death. In the 1850s, reports of the haunting began to circulate more widely in the neighborhood. In 1859, a man named Myers bought the house at 50 Berkeley Square. The story goes that he had been jilted by his beautiful fiancée. He retreated to an attic room of the huge house and slowly went mad as the once gorgeous home fell into disrepair. He was rumored to walk the house at night, candle in hand, to light his dismal way, weeping and calling out his faithless fiancée's name. During the day, he shut himself up in his tiny attic room, only answering the door to his servant, who brought him food and drink. In the 1870s and 1880s, long after Myers was gone, the house sat empty. The stories of fatal hauntings and a brooding homeowner worked their dark magic on the imaginations of many in the neighborhood. The neighbors spoke of ghostly phenomena disturbing the peace of Berkeley Square. At number 50, windows were thrown open. Bells rung stridently at all hours of the day and night. Stones and books were tossed outside, and the furniture was thrown around the house. The owners tried to rent out the vacant property, but nobody in the area wanted anything to do with 50 Berkeley Square. The house sat empty until Christmas Eve of 1887. Two sailors from the frigate HMS Penelope were on shore leave, carousing their way through London. Edward Blunden and Robert Barton had drunk all their money and were stumbling through the streets in search of a warm place to sleep. It was starting to snow when they reached 50 Berkeley Square. Seeing the "for rent" sign on it, the sailors decided no harm would come of their spending the night there. They staggered their way up to the second floor bedroom. Martin soon fell fast asleep, but Blunden tossed and turned, too keyed up to sleep. Also, he kept hearing scratching, dragging footsteps in the hallway outside the room. At around 2 in the morning, Robert Martin cannoned out of the front door of the house, gibbering and hysterical with fright. He stared widely around the square. He caught sight of a policeman walking his beat and raced over to him. Martin stammered out a nearly incoherent story about how he and Blunden had broken into the empty house to spend the night. They had been attacked by something horrible, but Martin couldn't describe what it was. He could only gibber about some dark and shapeless thing with a gaping mouth. He begged the policeman to come back to the house with him. He had escaped, but he was afraid for Blunden. The front door of number 50 was open. The policeman cautiously went into the house, with Martin following fearfully behind him. They searched the house but found no monster. They did find Blunden's shattered body impaled on the decorative iron railings of the basement steps. He had made it out of the house, right through the second floor window. Edward Blunden's neck had snapped in the fall. His face was frozen in terror. The sight of that face followed the policeman in his dreams for the rest of his life. Wow. Okay, Night Hall. Pacific University, a liberal arts school in Forest Grove, Oregon, is home to an elegant building called Night Hall. The former private residence is painted a pleasant muted gray, and the white gingerbread trim gives a nod to its Victorian-era beginnings. In the late 1940s, the house served as a woman's dormitory. In 1959, the music department moved into Night Hall. In the fall of 1974, a student night watchman had an unusual encounter in the building. As he went about his rounds, checking the building, he could hear a singer, a woman, still practicing in a third-floor library. The watchman went up to the third floor to tell the singer it was time for her to leave. As he went further up the stairs, the second floor, then the third floor, he began to feel a stirring sense of unease, for no good reason. As soon as he reached the third floor landing, the singing stopped abruptly. The watchman opened the door to the library. No one was in the room. The student, suspecting he was being pranked, searched the room for a hidden tape recorder. He found nothing. So assuming it hadn't been a prank, someone must actually have been singing, and had somehow slipped past him. He searched the entire house for the intruder. He searched the third floor. He searched the second floor. As he trotted down the staircase to the first floor, he saw his mysterious singer. A filmy, bluish-white mist, in the vague shape of a woman, was standing in front of a professor's office. As the stunned watchman stared, the figure drifted away and disappeared. The student watchman didn't quit his job after that encounter, but he did get a large German shepherd to keep him company on his nightly rounds. One night, as the watchman was about to go into Night Hall, the dog started growling. The hackles on its back rose, and it whined and jumped up at the window, teeth snapping on air. But when the watchman went up to the front door, the dog flatly refused to go into the building. Night Hall just didn't get checked that night. In 1979, two reporters from the student paper spent the night in the beautiful old building. They retreated to a smorgasbord of paranormal activity. They heard footsteps. They had the lights turned out for them. They heard long, rustling skirts brush past them, and they heard a woman's alto voice singing. Whoever this spirit was, she had a sense of humor. One of the reporters sat down at the piano and began to play, hoping to attract the spirit's attention. A female voice whispered in his ear, "Oh, please stop." Not once, but twice. The reporters came back with some friends the next night. When one of the friends sat down to play the piano, everyone in the room heard a heavy, long-suffering sigh. The ghost of Night Hall is nicknamed Vera. On the strength of an Ouija board session held in 1969, a spirit said her name was Vera Herrick, daughter of John Herrick, and she had been a student at the university from 1883 to 1887. Interestingly, Reverend John Herrick was president of Pacific University at the time. But when the investigators checked school records, they discovered that Reverend Herrick did not have a daughter named Vera. The only Vera the researchers uncovered was Vera Carolyn Jackson, who was a music student at the university from 1902 to 1904. This presents a problem with the timeline of the haunting. Night Hall didn't become the music building until 1959. There's also the fact that the first reports of a haunting in the hall date back to 1949, when it was still a woman's dorm. 10 years before, the music department moved in. Whether the spirit is Vera Herrick or Vera Jackson or someone else entirely, the fact remains that Night Hall is most definitely haunted. In the early 1980s, Dr. Donald Sweja, that's what it looks like, a retired music professor, came to the building on Christmas Day. He wanted to record some music, and a home filled with family celebrating the holiday was not the place to do it. While Dr. Sweja was in the middle of recording, he heard footsteps coming down the corridor. Annoyed, the professor walked quietly to the door. He was not about to have someone speak and inadvertently ruin the tape. This was precisely what he had hoped to avoid by recording in the empty music building instead of his house. But Dr. Sweja eased the door open to warn whoever it was to keep quiet. But no one was there. Spooky. Okay. So here we are, the next story. In fact, this gentleman is going to be a guest on our show a week after next. So the story is attacked in a hospital bed. Lon Strickler, he'll be on the show in a couple of weeks, who runs the blog Phantoms and Monsters, is no stranger to the supernatural. He has made it his mission to search the world for accounts of strange, unusual, and just plain weird. Long goes looking for the paranormal on a daily basis, and sometimes the paranormal finds him. Long posted a story on his blog about an experience he had in early January of 2017. He was in the hospital, waiting to have some tests run. Suddenly, as he lay in his bed, he was attacked by some sort of female spirit energy. The spirit wrapped her hands around Long's throat and started to choke him. He was able to fight the spirit off, but the experience stayed with him. When his nurse returned to the room, she asked, startled, "Where did you get those marks in your throat?" Intrigued by the experience, Juan put out a call to the readers of his blog, asking people to write to him if they'd had similar encounters. A reader, who has to be identified only as JCG, wrote in to tell us something that had happened to a friend of hers. JCG's friend lived in Santiago de Querétaro, Mexico. She worked at a local hospital as a nurse. At around 4 a.m. on December 24th, she went to the break room to catch a quick nap. She had just laid down on one of the cots and closed her eyes when she felt someone slap her knees. Thinking it was one of her co-workers trying to get her attention, she sat up. As soon as she sat up, a spirit wearing a hospital gown attacked her. The spirit grabbed the nurse by the throat, trying to strangle her. She tried to fight it off, but the spirit grabbed her flailing arm. Desperately, the nurse tried to scream for help, but the ghostly pressure on her throat muted her cries. Finally, her co-worker heard the commotion and came to find out what was going on. When the other nurse rushed into the room, the spirit flew out the window. Neither of the two women ever saw its face. The second nurse never even saw the attacking spirit, but she did see the angry red bruises on her co-worker's neck. A game of billiards. In the fall of 1943, World War II was raging across Europe. Lieutenant Colonel O'Donovan, an English artillery officer, was given command of two field batteries and told to prepare his men for an attack on the German army. The artillerymen were given quarters in various buildings on an estate in the Midlands. The officers stayed in the manor house. The estate was surrounded by acres of beautifully kept parkland, land that was soon chewed to bits of turf by the lobbing of artillery shells in practice. When Colonel O'Donovan arrived at the estate, the manor house was virtually deserted. The lord of the manor was off fighting the war, and his wife was living elsewhere. The only people left behind to care for the estate and its grand house were two old servants who had been employed with the family for many years. Like every good English manor house, the estate was home to a ghost. The butler told O'Donovan shortly after the officer's arrival that before the troops had been assigned to the estate, someone else had lived there for a brief time. On learning of the ghost, the man had moved out in a hurry. Colonel O'Donovan didn't chastise the butler for telling ghost stories, but he also didn't believe him either. The colonel had more important things on his mind, like getting his men ready for battle. But he wanted the butler to think of him and his men as guests in the manor house, rather than intruders. He hired the butler to help him put together an officer's mess. The butler agreed that this would bring some calmness to the empty house. It was agreed. The officers would gather for their main meal at 7:45 every evening. A couple of weeks later, Colonel O'Donovan was on his way down to the hall where the officers met for supper. Glancing at a clock in the hallway, he realized it was only 6:45. He was an hour early. Making a mental note to check his watch for accuracy, he wondered how he was going to pass the time until supper. It was a chilly fall night, and there was a fireplace in the hall where the officers ate their evening meals. The thought of spending some time relaxing by a cheerful fire held a lot of appeal. But just as the colonel was about to head for the hall, he heard a sound that pleased him even more than the crackle of a cozy fire. It was the click of billiard balls, and it was coming from a nearby room, a room the colonel hadn't been in before. He opened the door and found a full-size billiards table in the center of a large room. Racks of cue sticks lined the walls. A youngish man in army dress blues, was shooting balls on the table, just messing around, not seriously, playing the game. His outfit reminded O'Donovan of the uniform worn by General Kitchener's soldiers in World War I. The colonel was briefly surprised by the boy. The boy had been found fit for service, as his back was curved into a pronounced widow's hump. O'Donovan went over to the racks on the wall and selected a cue stick. "Want a game?" he asked. He was an avid player, and it had been too long since he'd enjoyed a game of billiards. The young man nodded with a ready smile. O'Donovan racked up the balls, and the game began. The young man was a good player, as good as O'Donovan himself was, and soon the score stood at 98-98. The colonel could hear the clump of army boots in the hallway, and he knew the other officers were coming in for the evening meal. The colonel took his final shot and scored 2 more points easily. He'd won the game. "That's done it," he said. "My game," the young man smiled again, accepting O'Donovan's narrow victory. He put his cue back on the rack and walked out of the room through another door. O'Donovan shook his head, a bit bemused. He thoroughly enjoyed the game, but he found it odd that the young man had never uttered a single word. He joined his fellow officers in the dining room, but his mind kept straying to the billiards table and the strange young man. Halfway through the meal, O'Donovan decided to ask his men if they had seen the kid in the dress blues. No one had. "A nice enough lad with a hump," O'Donovan continued. "I've just beaten him at billiards." Just then, O'Donovan noticed the stricken look on the butler's face. The man was standing frozen and pale in the act of serving dessert. "You've seen Master Willie, sir." The colonel pressed the butler to explain. Master Willie was her ladyship's brother. He managed to join up with Kirshner's army back in 1915. But when the officers discovered that he was deformed, they discharged him. He came home to the manor at Christmas 1960. He played a good game of billiards. Then he unalived himself in the room where he loved to play.
All right. Explains that, huh?
The Mutiny on the Junior. Many people live on Martha's Vineyard because of its beauty and history. Many more people visit the vineyard as tourists. And some of the year-round residents are, well, more permanent than most. They've been there all their lives and beyond. A Victorian Inn on South Water Street caters to the vacationers that visit Martha's Vineyard. This description of the stately inn comes from Holly Nadler's wonderful book, Haunted Island. Tall windows and white Corinthian columns face a narrow lane with grace and purity typical of the grandeur homes erected in the second half of the 19th century. The mansard roof, added in the late 1980s, altered a steeply pitched attic space into a highly serviceable third floor. Inside the inn, the window lace is homey, and the antique furniture is handsome, yet reassuringly lived in. A 4-poster bed, cozy comforter, and a teddy bear adorn each bedroom. You feel you've entered an actual Victorian abode, rather than the too glossy reproduction from a decorator's source book. Sounds like an appealing place indeed, and it is a ghost hunter's paradise. The owner, Kathy Appert, heard a woman's infectious laughter from behind a closed door the morning after she bought the inn. Visitors to the inn have had their own encounters with the resident spirits. The previous owners had trouble with a poltergeist who would chuck furniture out into the hall during the night. On one night, the prankster managed to wedge a large wicker chair into a small closet of an unoccupied room. It took 2 employees yanking at it to work it loose the next day. In another room, the poltergeist would scatter an assortment of old-fashioned hairpins, always on the same section of the carpet. Other guests have spoken of waking late at night to see a man in a dark suit sitting in an armchair in a room, calmly smoking a pipe. This spirit ignores the living, but not all of them are so obvious. Kathy's daughter was straightening one of the upstairs bedrooms when she heard a man's voice snarl, "Get out!" There was no one in the room with her at the time. A tourist from New York had a deeply unsettling experience when she spent a night at the inn. The room in which she stayed had tall windows overlooking the harbor and a set of French doors opening onto a wide balcony. Sometime past midnight, the young woman came awake with a start. One of the balcony doors had blown open with a bang. A tall man with a glorious mane of silver-white hair sauntered into the room. He came over to the woman's bed as she lay there, rigid with fear. When he got to the bedside, the ghost reached out and playfully tweaked. I can't say this. Okay, how am I going to get around this? And playfully tweaked her torso. We're just going to leave it there, okay? Then he ambled back to the balcony and closed the door behind him. The woman lay in her bed trying to process what had just happened. About a minute later, the balcony doors opened again. Standing outside were 5 men who looked like they'd just come from the set of Pirates of the Caribbean. Whalers with mutton chop whiskers, unruly beards, and layers of tattered clothing that had seen hard use as the men toiled on their vessel. The men started to move into the room. Had they come in search of the white-haired gentleman who had so rudely interrupted the woman's sleep? They had taken several steps into the room when the young woman found her voice. She sat up in bed and shrieked, go away. The five men didn't turn around and head for did not turn around and head for the balcony door. They simply vanished. Martha's Vineyard has always been home to men who made their living from the sea. Many lost their lives to this harsh mistress. One of the men who gloried in the demanding life of a whaling ship captain was Lafayette Rowley. Born into a family with seawater in his blood, his father was a master mariner. Rowley signed up for his first whaling expedition when he was just 15 years old. Rowley showed an aptitude for the technical side of life at sea, and due to his father's influence, he was trained in navigation at an age when other youngsters were serving simply as cabin boys. It was a stroke of luck, both that Rowley had the innate talent to learn and that there was a sailor on board with the foresight to teach him on that first voyage. Both the captain and the first mate died of scurvy. It fell to the teenage Rowley to guide the ship and its crew safely back to port. For his cool head and natural talent, Rowley was soon rewarded with command of his own vessel. Rowley would later serve as master mariner of the Orozimbo, the Neptune, the Citizen, and the Junior. It was the Junior that was the setting of a tragic event that may have left its mark on Rowley, and subsequently on the home where he spent much of his time. In 1856, Captain Thomas Mellon recruited a fresh crew in New Bedford to bolster the Junior's numbers for a planned whaling expedition to the South Seas. Mellon's veteran crew were suspicious of the newcomers right from the start. The new recruits were unfriendly, even downright surly. Even worse, they seemed to deliberately undermine the captain's authority and the ship's morale. When stationed in the crow's nest, for example, they would forget to announce a whale singing, not an ideal habit for a crew of a whaling ship. On December 25, 1856, 156 days into the voyage, the Junior was under sail several miles off the coast of New Zealand. The crew Mellon had picked up in New Bedford chose their moment to act. Brandishing pistols they'd hidden in their duffel bags, they burst into Captain Mellon's cabin and shot him, unaliving him. Then they unalived the first mate in his cabin. The ill-fated ship even eventually found its way back to New England. It was cleaned up, and Lafayette Rowley was chosen to be its new captain in 1857. That same year, he built his future family's home, the home that would later become the Victorian Inn. Was there psychic residue hanging around the Junior from the evil deeds of that Christmas day in 1856? Did it follow Rowley to his new home? The five bedraggled spirits who sauntered into the young woman's bedroom may have been fugitive ghosts from the Junior, either its original crew searching for their unlucky captain and first mate, or the murdering mutineers who, on the prowl, were looking for the same men. Okay. Man Overboard. Arnie Nicholson leaned against the rail on the deck of the Horgus Silver Spray. The Norwegian sailor was homesick. It was Christmas Eve, 1955. But instead of being home with his family, he was spending the holiday working in the Gulf of Mexico, many hundreds of miles from home. But that, at times, was the life of a sailor. Arnie sighed and took one last look at the moon, which lit the waves with a soft silver glow. At least he could imagine that perhaps his family, gathered for their Christmas Eve celebration, might be gazing up at the same silver moon and thinking of him. His eyes still on the moon, Arnie reached for the deck rail, but he had misjudged the distance in the moonlight. Grabbing frantically at the air, Arnie felt himself falling. He hit the water with a splash and kicked to the surface in a panic. "Help! Help!" he yelled, hoping that against all odds one of his shipmates would hear his voice above the noise of the ship's engines. But the silver spray steamed away into the darkness without him. Arnie beat the water in front of him in frustration and terror, sending splashes of drops into the night air. He looked around, treading water. He was sure there was no more terrifying place to be than in the middle of the dark sea in the middle of the night. Arnie knew he was miles from the land. The Gulf of Mexico was about 600,000 square miles of dark water, 1,000 miles across at its broadest point. If he struck out swimming in the wrong direction, he was sure to die of exhaustion long before he reached any shore. Arnie stayed afloat for hours, buoyed by the salt water of the Gulf, but his strength and his morale were both flagging. He'd seen several ships pass, but no matter how loud he yelled, he hadn't been able to attract anyone's attention. All Christmas Day, he floated, buffeted by the gentle Gulf waves. He was still terrified of swimming in the wrong direction, so he tried to stay put as the sun went down on another day. But he was terrified of swimming in the wrong direction. So he tried to stay put as the sun went down on another day. But he had to do something soon. He couldn't just float forever, or he'd end up floating forever. He put that thought hurriedly out of his mind. The moon rose, as big as beautiful as it had been on Christmas Eve. Had it really only been the night before that he'd fallen overboard? His ship was miles away by now, and he had no idea where the nearest land was. It seemed impossible that he could die here, in the welcoming warm Gulf waters, on Christmas Day. Arnie shook his head, blinking salt water out of his eyes. There were two men, shipmates of his, and they were walking towards him, across the water, on a silvery path of moonlight. Arnie seemed to hear ghostly voices coming to him across the water. "If you swim toward the moon," the voices said, "you'll reach safety. Summoning the last of his strength, Arnie kicked out and started swimming in the direction of the moon. He swam as hard as he could, lifting his head every so often to keep the glowing moon in his sights. A few hours later, when Arnie looked around for the moon, he also saw the lights of a tanker ahead of him. In the gray light of the oncoming dawn, he could just make out the British flag that snapped in the Gulf breeze. He yelled and waved, frantic to get the tanker's attention. Several minutes later, Arnie Nicholson was being pulled aboard the British Surveyor. "Follow the path of the moon," his ghostly guides had been right. The old man in the theater. On Christmas night, 1933. Mr. Lewis Amiss, a fireman, working the night shift at the brand new Streatham Astoria Theater in London, was patrolling the empty building. What follows is his account of what he saw that night. "I was making my rounds through the darkened theater shortly after midnight, and as I entered the tea lounge, I saw a figure advancing towards me. Thinking it must be a burglar, I turned my flashlight full on him and saw the figure of an old man dressed in a long white gown with a hood over his head, gliding across the floor, his arms held out stiffly at his side. I caught a glimpse of a wizened, wrinkled face and short beard. Then he turned away from me and moved towards the stairs leading down to the vestibule. As Ames followed, the spirit floated down to the theater, flinging the heavy theater doors open as it went. The ghost glided down the center aisle and across the orchestra pit. It came to a stop behind the footlights in front of the stage curtain. The ghost turned to face Ames, lifted its hand, and cried out in a weird, gravelly voice, 'I won't sell! I won't sell! I won't sell!' Then it vanished. Of course, no one believed Ames. Believed his fantastic story. But then, evidence came to light that did much to explain the strange encounter. 4 years before, in 1929, there wasn't a theater on the site. There was a house, a lovely, comfortable house, occupied by a Mr. James. Mr. James and his wife were under constant pressure from developers to sell their pleasant little house. Mr. James didn't want to leave his home, but the developers eventually wore him down. Mr. and Mrs. James sold their house, which was promptly demolished to make room for the planned theater. The couple moved to a house in Streatham, and soon after the move, Mr. James died. Lewis Ames had never even heard of Mr. James, but James's widow confirmed Lewis's description of her late husband. Yes, Mr. James had had a beard, and yes, he had been very attached to his beloved home, and extremely reluctant to give it up in the name of progress. No wonder he wandered the aisles of that theater that night, upset over the demolition of his tidy little home. All right, next one is the abduction of Oliver Larch. Christmas Eve in 1989 was the festive time for the Larch family of Indiana. Friends were gathered in the Larch home to help celebrate the holiday. The guests included a minister and his wife from nearby South Bend, and a circuit judge and an attorney who had traveled all the way from Chicago. The Larches welcomed these out-of-town guests. The more, the merrier. After Christmas dinner, the party moved into the parlor. Matthew Larch sat down at the pump organ. Soon the cozy farmhouse was filled with the rich sound of voices raised in song. Even after such a glorious dinner, everyone still had room for a snack. Young Oliver Larch, 11 years old, popped corn in the fireplace, and the guests ate handfuls of the treat. Through the windows, the sight of the fluffy falling snow made a pleasant picture of the season. Around midnight, Matthew, on a trip to the kitchen for a drink, noticed that the water in the cistern was low. Oliver, always ready with a helping hand, cheerfully volunteered to bring in several buckets of fresh water. He clambered into a warm jacket and overshoes, grabbed a bucket, and headed outside to the pump. Mere moments after the door closed behind the boy, a scream tore through the night. The Larches and their guests were stunned into silence for a moment. Then Matthew lunged for a lantern, and everyone raced outside. Oliver's footprints led from the kitchen door to a spot about 75 feet from the house. There, they simply stopped. There were no other tracks in the freshly fallen snow, and there was no sign of Oliver. "Help! They've got me!" The boy's shriek echoed in the yard. "Help! Help me, please!" The child's voice seemed to come from somewhere in the dark skies above. As everyone stared upwards, Oliver's voice grew fainter and fainter. Then, all was silent. It was as if the boy had been snatched away into thin air. My neighbors are having a Super Bowl party. You can hear the noises. The women led Oliver's sobbing mother into the house, while the men made a frantic search of the farm. They found no trace of the boy, nothing to tell them where he'd gone. The police were called, and they, too, made a thorough investigation. Based on the evidence and reports from the baffled witnesses, Oliver Larch must have been swept up into the sky. Eerier still, there had been no lights but the lantern that Matthew Larch carried. No sounds except for the boy's terrified screams, echoing from the endless black of the night sky. Oliver Larch was never seen again. Hi, Daniel. Bartholomew Rudd's Christmas Guest. It was snowing heavily that Christmas Eve in Fountain City, Wisconsin. The small town, still a bit rough around the edges in this year of 1866, lay nestled near the Michigan River. Good people lived here, and Christmas Eve services were held at midnight. The songs and quiet worship brought a sense of peace and contentment to the frontier town. Bartholomew Rudd had attended that midnight Christmas Eve service. Now he was headed home. Having reached the age of 53 as a confirmed bachelor, he was resigned to not having a wife and children waiting for him at home. He would spend the holiday alone, or so he thought. As Rudd walked home through the falling snow, his soul swelled with the warmth of the season. He loved his town, and the walk home from the church was pleasant, even with the chill in the air. In the quiet peace of the houses he passed, he could imagine children tucked snugly in their beds, dreaming of the gifts St. Nicholas would bring in the night. The falling snow laid a blanket of silence over the dark streets. The only sound that came to Rudd's ears was the crunch of his own boots on the thick snow. Wait, that wasn't quite right. As Rudd walked along, it seemed to him that he could hear another set of footfalls, almost an echo of his own. But that was absurd. The streets were dark and deserted. No one was abroad on the silent night. There it was again. Footsteps just slightly out of time with his own steps. And he was absolutely certain he was alone on the street. He hated to admit it, but a prowler or pickpocket would have no respect for the sanctity of Christmas Eve. Rudd picked up his pace. He couldn't see anyone hiding in the shadows, but that didn't mean he wasn't being followed. He reached the safety of his front steps, panting and slightly out of breath from his quick walk. He turned around, hoping he wasn't about to be mugged on the steps of his own house. The street behind him was empty. The only thing following him was the swirling snow, and the only tracks of the snow were those left by his own boots. Rudd stomped the snow from his boots before unlocking his door. Then he stopped, as something odd registered in his mind. The snow was still falling thickly, but the shoulders and sleeves of his greatcoat were dry. He wore no hat, and he could feel the fluffy flakes hitting his hair. But when he pulled off a glove and reached up, his hair felt dry too. It was as if he'd companionably shared a friend's umbrella on the walk home from the church. No snow had touched him. What a strange evening. Rudd shook his head. He'd heard of Christmas miracles. He just never thought such a thing would happen to him. He unlocked his door and went inside, pausing to hang up his greatcoat and pull off his boots. His toes were chilled, and he was looking forward to poking his hearth fire back to life. He took several steps into his study before he registered a figure sitting in the chair next to the fire. Rudd stopped, confused and a little alarmed. Before he could call for help, though, the figure leaned down and prodded the fire with the poker. The fire blazed up cheerfully, and Rudd recognized the stranger. Andrew? Andrew Putnam? The figure stood, a stranger no more. Bartholomew! So good to see you! The men shook hands. They had been friends since childhood, growing up together in the Wisconsin River town. Adulthood had seen the men go their separate ways. Rudd had been content to stay in Fountain, and Andrew Putnam, meanwhile, had gone off to seek his fortune in the East. He'd ended up in Washington, D.C. He currently held a position in Andrew Johnson's administration. Well, I'll be Andrew Putnam, back in rustic Fountain City for a visit. It was so kind of you to stop by to see me, and on Christmas Eve, too. Rudd was pleased beyond measure for the chance to catch up with his old friend. Have you eaten? My housekeeper keeps a good pantry. Let's have a late supper. Thanks, that sounds wonderful, Putnam said. If you don't mind, I'll stay here by the fire while you play the host. I'm still quite chilled from my journey. Of course, of course. Make yourself comfortable, please. Rudd hurried to the kitchen and threw together two heaping platefuls of food. Cold roast beef, hard-boiled eggs, good cheese, a bowl full of nuts for cracking, stout sourdough bread, and a pot of his housekeeper's marvelous apple butter, put up just that fall and fragrant with spices. He grabbed two bottles of ale as well and brought the whole heavy tray into the study. If Putnam was reluctant to leave the cozy fire, and Rudd didn't fault him for that, why, they'd just eat in front of the hearth. No harm in that. Rudd sat down and poured each bottle of ale into a glass. Merry Christmas to absent friends, absent no more. Putnam raised his glass with a grin. I'll drink to that. The men visited for a couple of hours, fondly reminiscing about their childhood in the town. Finally, though, Rudd yawned and realized the lateness of the hour. And here I call myself a good host, keeping you up until the wee hours of chatting. Well, have plenty of time to talk in the morning. You'll stay the night, won't you? Plenty of room at this inn for you, my friend. Putnam nodded. Of course I'll stay. Thank you. Rudd showed his friend to the door of the guest room and told him good night. Putnam merely nodded again. Rudd headed off to his own bed, but once he got there, he found it hard to drop off to sleep. He told himself it was just the excitement of Putnam's visit, plus the late supper, as he stared at the ceiling, waiting for his sleep to come. He finally dropped off to sleep around dawn. The housekeeper's knock on his door woke him. Merry Christmas, Mr. Rudd, sir. Your breakfast will be ready shortly. Bartholomew shook himself awake. He'd had only a few hours' sleep. Then he remembered. Andrew was here. Rudd dressed quickly and went to see if his friend was up and about yet. Surely the smell of his housekeeper's good coffee would have drawn him out of bed. On his way to the guest room, Bartholomew passed by the open door of the study. His steps slowed and stopped. He stared into the room, disbelieving the evidence right before his eyes. The small table still stood next to the fireplace, where the fire had long since smoldered down to ashes. Two glasses and two plates sat on the table, but only one of the plates was empty. The other was still piled high with food, and one glass was still full to the brim with ale, now gone warm and flat. Bartholomew hurried to the kitchen to find his housekeeper. Had Andrew perhaps left early that morning? But the astonished housekeeper swore that no one had left the house, and she'd been there since shortly after dawn, as usual. Nor had she made up the guest room, as no one had slept there the night before. Rudd spent Christmas Day wandering the house in a fog. Something was wrong, terribly wrong. He knew without a doubt that he'd enjoyed a conversation of several hours with his friend. but there was no sign that Andrew had ever been in the house. The two disparate facts nagged at him, an itch deep in his mind that could not be scratched. That night, Bartholomew fell asleep in the chair in front of the study fireplace. The other chair sat empty, almost mocking him. A knock on the front door woke him the next morning. Rudd sat up, rubbing his sleep from his eyes and stretching to relieve the kink in his back from spending the night in the chair. His housekeeper met him before he got halfway down the stairs. She handed him the telegram, which was postmarked, Washington, D.C. "Sir, the family of Andrew H. Putnam wishes to inform you of his death on the first day of December, 1866. We know you join us in mourning his passing." Stunned, Bartholomew read the two stark sentences over and over. The puzzle was finally solved. The crunch of footsteps accompanying him in the snow, the uneaten meal, the full glass of ale, the empty bed. Bartholomew Rudd had spent Christmas Eve visiting with a dead man. Sir Hughes's Goblet. Heatherden Hall stands in Staffordshire, England, home to the Lords of Hatherden since the time of the Crusades. This story, though, is of a more recent vintage. The Lord Heatherden, who held the title toward the end of the 19th century, was famed for the quality of his cellars. One Christmas Eve, he hosted a party for some of his friends, while their wives attended a party of their own. After dinner, Lord Heatherden and his friends went to his study for port and cigars. All the men were getting companionably sloshed when one of the guests picked something up from the Lord Heatherton's desk. He put it down again rather hastily when one of the guests picked... It was a human skull, lined with silver. Lord Heatherden picked it up with a grin. The skull, he said, had belonged in life to an ancestor of his, Sir Hugh Heatherden. Sometime after the gentleman's death, his tomb in a private chapel had been disturbed. His skull had found its way to the hands of one of his descendants, who thought it amusing to line it with silver and use it as a goblet. The skull goblet got mixed reactions from the guests. Some of them were chilled, but strangely fascinated by the grisly relic. Others were completely appalled and wanted nothing to do with drinking from it. Just then, with a wicked knowing grin, the current Lord Heatherden called for some brandy. All the guests knew of the quality of the Lord's liquor. It was the offer of fine brandy that broke the ice. His guests soon forgot their disgust, and Sir Hugh's skull was filled to the brim and passed around the room. The guests even toasted Sir Hugh with his own skull, inviting him to come spend Christmas Eve with the partiers. Lord Heatherden, the tipsiest of them all, even swore that if Sir Hugh did show, he'd give him back his skull. At the stroke of midnight, someone set the skull back on the desk, and then every man in the room heard footsteps in the hall outside the study. These were not the footsteps of their wives, light from an evening of dancing at the ball. These were the heaviest footsteps of a man, a large man. A noise came from the desk, and everyone turned to look. The skull rolled slowly to the edge of the desk, then fell to the floor and rolled underneath it. That was creepy enough, but then the door of the study slammed open. A bone-chilling blast of air swept the room, and there in the doorway stood a headless knight in full armor. Every man in the room froze. The knight gave a sarcastic, exaggerated bow, turned, and walked with dignity down the hallway. When the wives returned a little while later, their husbands were all stone-cold sober. Many of them insisted on leaving a light on when they retired for the night. The next morning, the skull had vanished from under the desk. The silver plate lining was found on the lawn outside the study. The skull itself was never seen again. Wow. Blood Brothers. This tale comes from the brooding mountains and dark hollows of Appalachia. A young man from West Virginia was engaged to be married to a beautiful girl, but the dark clouds of World War I loomed on the horizon, far across the ocean from his mountain home. The young man was called up sooner than he had expected, and he was shipped off to Germany before he could marry his sweetheart. After he had gone, the man's older brother came a-courting. He convinced the girl that the soldier had never really loved her. Why, if he had, he wouldn't have left her all alone, now would he? Soon, he talked the girl into marrying him instead. On Christmas Eve, the soldier returned home unexpectedly. He went straight to the house where his brother lived with his wife, the wife that should have been his. The soldier knocked on the door, and the brother let him in. The brother was on edge during their whole conversation, and his wife was just upstairs. In an irritated whisper, he told the soldier that, yes, he had married the girl simply for her money and for her family's position in society. He warned his younger brother, in a low but urgent tone, that if he interfered with the marriage in any way, he would kill him dead. The soldier nodded in grudging understanding. Conversation had gone just about the way he'd expected. He left the house, hearing the door close firmly behind him. The younger brother returned to the house a little while later with a revolver. He shot his older brother, then stormed out the house. The young wife heard the shot and hurried downstairs. She found her husband dying in a spreading pool of his own blood on the floor. With his final agonized breaths, he told her what had happened. She called the police, who searched the property thoroughly. They could find no trace of the murderous young soldier. On Christmas Day, a telegram arrived. It was addressed to the older brother. His widow opened it and read it. The telegram said that the younger brother had been killed in action on December 21st. Wow. Christmas music. Peter Guarino and Paul Willer bought their house at 25 Orange Street in Nantucket in 1971. The couple had been living in Manhattan and considered themselves New Yorkers down to the bone. But they had vacationed on Nantucket in 1969, and the island seemed like a paradise to them after the bustle and hustle of the city of city living. It took 2 years, but they eventually found the property on Orange Street. The moment they set foot inside the house, they both knew they'd finally found their dream home. They immediately felt comfortable in the house. They never dreamed it would turn out to be haunted. Peter tells the story. We had a strange but very pleasant recurring experience our first 4 years in the house. At midnight, every Christmas Eve, we would hear organ music coming from the third floor. It lasted for about 10 minutes. It wasn't any Christmas music that we recognized, but it was beautiful. When we went up there, we could hear it more clearly, but we couldn't pinpoint the spot that it was coming from. Needless to say, there was no organ there. When the couple had moved into the house, they discovered that the third floor was stuffed with boxes of sheet music. Peter did a little research and found out that the previous owner, a Mr. Snelling, had served as the minister of St. Paul's Episcopal Church. Mr. Snelling had lived in the house at 25 Orange Street for many years and used the third floor as his study. He also had an organ moved up to the third floor. When Mr. Snelling died, his widow donated their home to the church. The church used the house for a while, then it sat silent and empty for years before the couple from New York bought it. As we see it, Mr. Snelling was making up for those years when the house had no music on Christmas Eve, says Peter. Okay. We got about 8 more minutes here. So, a celestial choir. This tale comes from the website paranormal.about.com. The contributor, Mel, lived in Klamath Falls, Oregon. On Christmas Eve, 1978, Mel was awakened at around 3 a.m. by the sweet sounds of a choir in full voice. Mel's home was miles from the nearest church. Mel couldn't make out any words or even follow the tune, but the sound was unmistakable. The joyful pan of voice raised in worship. I got a feeling of angelic exaltation, reference, and gladness of heart, Mel wrote. This was truly a heavenly choir, lifting their voices on high, singing Hosanna in the highest in an unknown tongue without accompaniment of instruments. Mel did some investigating and realized that the music wasn't coming from the radio or television. Mel wandered outside, and strangely, the music wasn't heard outdoors. But Mel couldn't deny the exuberance in the glorious music, the way the countless male, female, and children's voices entwined together, the tonals going from operatic highs to the deepest bass voices in perfect harmony. It must have lasted 10 minutes, but it was touching for an eternity. Midnight Mass. In 1885, a man named Charles Corey, shared the following story for a collection of ghostly tales. His grandfather, a man by the name of Chatton, was traveling on business one Christmas Eve. It had snowed heavily all day long, and all the familiar landmarks on his route were covered with white drifts. Fearing he would lose his way, Chatton decided to walk beside his horse rather than ride. He happened to pass the ruins of an ancient chapel on the way home. As he trudged past, he heard bells chiming. Midnight. Then the tinkling of lighter bells, as if parishioners were being called to Mass. Chatton was intrigued. Was it possible that the chapel of St. Christopher had been restored? He hadn't noticed as he passed it that morning. He came closer to the chapel as the bells continued to peal. The chapel looked beautiful in the moonlight. Warm light spilled invitingly from the windows. Chatton tied his horse to the gate and went inside. Every pew in the chapel was filled with people, but the place was really silent, except for the merrily ringing bells. Maybe the devout congregation was lost in fervent prayer. As he couldn't find a seat, Chatton knelt on the flagstones near the entrance. The priest and his server were busy at the altar. Midnight Mass had begun. Chatton was thrilled to attend the Mass in such a beautifully restored little chapel. The priest turned toward the parishioners to give a blessing, and Chatton was struck by the intensity of the priest's gaze. Those bright eyes seemed to be fixed on him, to single him out from the rest of the congregation. The priest lifted the host and held it up, saying in a strangely hollow voice, "Is there anyone here who can receive?" Silence reigned in the small chapel. Three times the priest repeated his call to communion. Chatton got to his feet, a little irritated that the rest of the people had ignored the priest's invitation. Chatton assured the priest that he had gone to confession just that morning before setting off on his trip. He had intended to take communion the next day, on Christmas Day. "But if you wish it," Chatton said, "I am ready to receive the body and blood of our Lord at once." The change in the priest's expression was instant and dramatic. His pinched, sallow face lit up with a happy relief. He came down the altar steps and met Chatton at the communion rail. Chatton knelt in reverence and received the host. "May my blessings rest upon you, Chatton," the priest said. Chatton glanced up in surprise. How had the priest known his name? But he had no time to wonder. "Once, on a snowy Christmas Eve, just this, I refused to go and give the last rites to a dying person. That was 300 years ago. I could not be delivered from purgatory until one of the living should consent to receive communion from my hand. Thanks to you, I shall now be released." The moment the priest finished speaking, the torches went out, plunging the chapel into darkness. When Chatton could see once again, he realized he was standing alone in the ruins of the chapel. Snowflakes drifted down because the roof had vanished. Where the pews had been an instant before, now frost-killed nettles sagged under the weight of newly fallen snow. Chatton slogged his way through the dead weeds to the chapel door. He untied his horse, and together they walked away from the chapel of St. Christopher. This is the end of the book. We just made it on time. Check it out. So let me fix this. Hang on. I gotta do this puzzle. Wrong button. Let me try again. Okay, so that's the end of the book. So next week we will be starting a book called St. Andrew's Ghost Tales. And it's a Gutenberg.org book, and so that means it's out of copyright, which means it was probably written anywhere from the 1800s up to 1945. So we'll be starting that next Sunday, and we'll be back at our usual time at 5 p.m. Pacific on Sunday. Guys, I want to thank you all for coming today. I know everybody's eager to get their food together and stuff for the Super Bowl. What, another hour to go? And hope you guys enjoy the Super Bowl. I might be watching. I don't know yet. Haven't decided. I got to get my food together for the Super Bowl. But I just want to let you know that tomorrow at 4 p.m. there will not be any psychic readings tonight on TikTok. I'm taking the night off. And then tomorrow at 4 p.m. Pacific, I will be here, and we're going to be building a Valentine's Day gingerbread house, putting that together. And then at 7 p.m. Pacific, I will be back doing readings on TikTok, okay? Just to give you an idea of what the updates are. That's California Haunts on TikTok for everybody over on watching from YouTube. On Wednesday, we are going to be talking to a psychic who is going to tell us about remote reading, and also a real estate agent who is going to tell us how to research a property that you think might be haunted. So that's going to be on Wednesday. That'll be at 5:30 p.m. Pacific. On Thursday, John Stewart is going to be with us. No, not the TV dude, but this gentleman, John Stewart, who has done a lot of research and found that the military may have interviewed an alien being. So That's going to be on Thursday. That will also be at 5:30 p.m. Pacific. Friday, of course, Nancy Matz will be with us with her whatever great topic she has. And to let you know, Tuesday is open, but I have someone, I'm speaking with someone from England, so that may be a noon show. I don't know yet. I haven't got confirmation on it yet. So it's going to be a busy week for us all the way around. And Friday night, 7 p.m. Pacific, the Love Doctor is in again, and I'm going to be doing some love tarot card readings for you guys on Friday night for those of you that are home Friday night, okay? Because it's Valentine's Day, right? So we'll be doing that as well. So it's going to be a busy week, and hopefully you join me, and I will see you over here on TikTok. I will see you tomorrow at 4 p.m. Pacific. I will, well, not so much on TikTok, even over here at all these other sites. I will see you guys tomorrow at 4 p.m. Pacific to decorate a Valentine's gingerbread house so we can start celebrating Valentine's Day. All right, guys, over on TikTok. I'll see you. Have a great evening. Thank you for coming. Okay, well, you heard it. You heard it right here. And, yeah, so I'll see you guys tomorrow, 4 p.m. Pacific. We're going to be building that gingerbread house. And then I'll stop around 6:30 so I can get set up for the card readings and stuff for tomorrow night. All right, guys, have a great day. Enjoy the Super Bowl, and I will see you all. Okay? Bye.